Hello and welcome to House to Astonish episode 62. I'm Paul O'Brien.
And I'm Al Kennedy. And in the week when the US finally formally dropped all charges against Osama bin Laden, we ask, is there light at the end of the tunnel for the Red Skull?
Coming up later, we'll be reviewing Graveyard of Empires, 15 Love and Kirby Genesis.
But first, a bit of the news. Starting off with, we were talking about terrorists there a second ago. Frank Miller has obviously had terrorists on his mind for, quite a long time now. Because his Holy Terror story, which originally was going to be Holy Terror Batman, is now coming out in September, just in time for the 10th anniversary of the September 11, 2001 attacks.
Okay, when Frank Miller first announced that he was working on a Batman story about Al-Qaeda, I think the general reaction was, that's going to be tasteful.
Yeah, and Batman versus Ra's Al-Qaeda, perhaps, that would have worked.
So does this now have no Batman content?
No, the superhero in this is now called The Fixer.
Right.
Which I would have thought there's a trademark dispute there, given that Marvel's got a character starring in Thunderbolts called The Fixer. But I don't know. Well, I suppose you can have... Marvel and DC have each got a scarecrow and all that kind of thing.
I think as long as he doesn't put it in the title or on the cover, it's not necessarily the end of the world that he's reused the name. Okay, so this is coming out in September, presumably not through DC.
No, it's Legendary Publishing, who are the Legendary Studios, the film studio. It kind of implies that there might be a film of this made eventually.
Well, a lot of things are put out by film studios. It's a bold move to be releasing anything in September when all eyes are going to be on DC. But this project has been in the pipeline forever.
Yeah,
I'm sure it'll look good. I'm sure I don't want to read it.
Yeah. To be honest, Frank Miller's stuff over the last few years, I really have not found his art to be at where it was at all. Pretty much everything from his Dark Knight sequel onwards has looked kind of the same. His later Sin City stuff wasn't even that great. I wonder if he's another one of these guys who has just gone off the boil.
Peaked a while back, maybe.
Yeah, I think
Mind you, at his peak, he was incredible.
Absolutely.
Even a bit below his peak, he's still very good.
I mean, we'll entertain Frank Miller's crazy just to see what kind of comics he's going to produce. He gets a bit of leeway. But then again, some people get a bit of leeway and then they produce nonsense. What about Neil Adams's Batman Odyssey?
Yeah, true. Spider-Man the Musical finally did open. 128 odd preview shows, wasn't it? Incredible like that.
Is it going to have more or fewer shows in its actual run than it had in its preview run?
Well, apparently it has been changed quite dramatically. Roberto Aguirre-Sacasa was brought in to try and salvage it, more or less, to try and turn it into something that would work as a Broadway show.
Without killing too many people in the process.
Yes.
This is a show that not only brought you suspension of disbelief, but also disbelief of suspension.
According to the reviews, it sounds as though what he's done is he's basically taken off the most off-the-wall and ludicrous elements, which, of course, were also the most distinctive elements, and tried to shoehorn what remains into a more conventional Broadway structure. And the consensus of the reviewers seems to be it's gone from jaw-droppingly terrible to merely below average. And in many ways, it was more entertaining when it was jaw-droppingly terrible. But, given what he had to work with, he has apparently salvaged it and turned it into something which has something going for it as a degree of spectacle.
Well, well done to him. I mean, I have to say I'm not completely convinced that this isn't going to go down in the annals of Broadway history as one of the most expensive mistakes that has ever been made. But if he's able to make it work well enough that people are actually entertained by it, who are we to judge it? The X-Men, sticking with Marvel characters, X-Men going into Schism in... Is it next month Schism launches?
Well, they've already got the Prelude to Schism miniseries running, although since that actually consists of characters standing around going, what shall we do? What shall we do? And now a 20-page flashback. It's not really a prelude to anything much so far.
Prelude to issue 4 of Prelude to Schism.
It's a bit more prelude-y in issue 3, to be fair. But
prelude-y is a new adjective which we have discovered.
Yeah, so this is the major storyline that's coming in the autumn. To be fair to the X-Books, they have been building up for quite some time the idea that at some point people are going to lose patience with the way Cyclops is running the team. Yeah. That is something they've been building up for ages. They put out this press release saying, we're cancelling Uncanny X-Men, and nobody cared. Because everybody knew... Well, first of all, they announced it in the immediate aftermath of DC's relaunch of its entire line.
Yeah.
But secondly, everyone knew they were just going to relaunch it the next month. And then a week or so later, another press release comes out saying, we're relaunching Uncanny X-Men with the same writer from issue 1. And it's, okay, so yes, exactly as we thought. Axel Alonso actually said in his press in his interview with Associated Press that we promised that from here on, every number one there's a good reason for. And you think, well, that'll be it.
Up till now, of course.
Well, yeah, I sat down and worked this out. Marvel, in the last year, have either relaunched or about to relaunch something in the region of 12 titles. Avengers, Fantastic Four, Thor, Captain America, Punisher, Ghost Rider... No, sorry, Ghost Rider doesn't count because it's been cancelled for a while. Moon Knight.
Mm-hmm.
What were the other ones? X-Force. Mm-hmm. Uncanny X-Men.
Mm-hmm.
There were definitely a couple more. So, you know, they do this very, very casually. And the idea that anyone is supposed to care that they're doing it again now, I think is, you know, self-deluding, to be honest.
You talk about sat-down work things.
That was one.
I sat and worked out... what will be the longest running Marvel series that have not either been relaunched and renumbered?
Black Panther, Hercules.
Yes. Well, what I worked out was that if you
this is just the memory.
Well, if you take the Age of Apocalypse as having just been a 4-month hiatus rather than a cancellation, relaunch, or in any way of a series, it was just a pause for 4 months, then the longest running Marvel series come October will be X-Men Legacy at 255 issues. Now, that's presuming that that's not cancelled because of the whole Schism thing. If it is cancelled because of the Schism thing, then the longest running Marvel title which has not been relaunched or renumbered is Astonishing X-Men. And if that is cancelled because of the Schism thing, the longest running Marvel title which has not been relaunched or renumbered is Avengers Academy. At 19 issues.
Well, they've also announced that there's going to be a second X-Men title, Wolverine and the X-Men, by Jason Aaron. Now,
I think, is it Chris Bacalo who's drawing
Jason
it?
Aaron and Chris Bacalo. Now, that obviously begs the question, are they cancelling something else to make room for Wolverine and the X-Men? Because if they add that to the existing reign, 5 X-Men titles a month, and some of them double shipping.
That's just in main continuity as well. Uncanny, Wolverine and the X-Men... adjectiveless, Astonishing and Legacy.
I would suspect that Wolverine and the X-Men is going to replace another title which is so unimportant they can't be bothered announcing that they're cancelling it. And the obvious candidate is Astonishing X-Men, which, you know, is now running 2 storylines that nobody is particularly bothered about. Daniel Way one's not bad, actually.
Are the two of them tying together in any way, the two storylines that are running?
No,
because
in no way.
If I'd known that, I would probably have picked up the Christos Gage side of things, because I like Gage, and Juan Bobbio is drawing it, and he's a great artist. I really love Juan Bobbio's stuff on She-Hulk.
Yes, so did I, and I don't think his art on Astonishing X-Men is in the same league, frankly.
Oh, okay, well, dodged a bullet there, then.
It's an off-the-shelf brood story. There's nothing particularly notable about
Fair
it.
Enough.
But I think I would expect Wolverine and the X-Men to replace Astonishing, or to replace conceivably X-Force, which is basically the same sort of book. But that's doing that's going quite well. I'd be surprised if they wanted to get rid of that. Then again, you might say once you've done Schism, there's no logical place for X-Force. But logic's
maybe
never
a Black Ops team for the Black Ops team.
Exactly. Logic's never really bothered Marvel in the way they approach the Marvel
Wolverine's like, I've got a Black Ops team that I can't even tell my Black Ops team about. It's infra black.
I don't, what happens to X-Men, the third X-Men title, who knows? Legacy, well, Legacy's spent most of the last few years as focusing on individual characters anyway, mm-hmm. and that's not so much a problem. That can be shifted off to do something else. But, I mean, logically, what they could be trying to announce through the back door is actually cutting from four X-Men titles to three.
Mm-hmm.
Let's hope.
Fingers crossed. Right, so that is the other news. We're going to go on to solicitations. We'll quickly burn through Image. Witchblade reaches 150 issues. Now, if, like me, you're surprised to learn that Witchblade is still being published, then this may come as something of a shock.
Apparently it's better than you'd think, Witchblade. I mean, neither of us have read it in years.
It will absolutely certainly be better than I think it is, yes.
It's apparently when Ron Mars took over, he very much dragged it away from the bad girl angle. And mm-hmm. Turned it into more the sort of comic he wanted to write. And there's apparently some very obvious hauling of the book in a different direction. But it's if your idea of Witchblade is based on what the book was like when it was first launched, then to be fair, apparently it's changed quite a bit since then.
Fair enough. And two new ongoing series being launched at Image in September. A book called Near Death by Jay Ferber and Simone Guglielmini, I believe.
Jay Ferber's usually quite interesting. I'll give that a shot.
Yeah, he's a solid writer. It's about a guy who is a hitman who has killed loads of people, has a near-death experience, and sees his vision of hell, and in order to stop himself from going to hell, decides he wants to balance the scales by saving a life for every life he's taken, and he's taken a lot of lives. So it's pitched as being a book for people who like Criminal.
Okay.
So, and a book called Pigs, which is by former Marvel editor Nate Cosby, Ben McCool, and artist Brando Timura. And this tagline for it is, there are terrorists in America, and they're coming for you.
Pigs.
Yeah.
Okay. So there you go.
Dark Horse, the only really major launch at Dark Horse is, I mean, there's a smattering of new Hellboy projects, which if you're a fan of the whole Hellboy verse, you'll probably want to take a look at. Buffy Series 9, following on the back of Faith and Angel launching last month.
Yeah, I was losing patience with Buffy towards the end of season 8, and then it kind of won me back in that final issue, where the aside from being a very obvious repositioning of the book in a different direction, it had that bit at the back from Joss Whedon basically saying, hey, you know all those things that didn't really work in Buffy season 8? I know! They won't be in season 9! I know there's a mentality in publishing and in comics that you never admit that something was a mistake.
Mm-hmm.
Honestly, I would have dropped that book. I was going to drop that book when it reached the end of the storyline. And I'm sticking with it now precisely because they said to me, we're not going to make that mistake again.
There it is. Marvel have a quiet month in September,
understandably. I would think, in fairness to Marvel, when you know DC is going to be deluging the market with 52 number ones, anything you can push back to October, you push back to October.
Yeah. The only really major things that are happening is Daredevil is joining the Avengers. That's something that Brian Bendis wanted to do back when the Ronin character debuted, and then everyone guessed it was Daredevil and he changed it to being Echo.
And I think, in fairness, once you've decided that your premise for the Avengers is it's the team in which all the major superheroes are members, it is a bit odd not to have Daredevil in there. Once you put people like Spider-Man and Moon Knight on the team.
Yeah, the solicitation for it is interesting because it says, you know, can Daredevil get redemption for his sins? It's like, well, I wonder where would be an appropriate place to tackle that story. Daredevil, maybe?
Well, you know, maybe they're going to run the same theme in both books. And, you know, it's...
I think I'd rather read Mark Waid's version.
It's Bendis' Avengers. They're not actually going to do a Daredevil-specific arc in Bendis' Avengers. What happens with every character who's brought into the Avengers is that they become one of the extra people standing around in the background while another arc goes on. He introduced Novar and did nothing, essentially, with him. He introduced Spider-Gwen.
Crap goatee.
Yeah, I mean, he doesn't... One of the problems with Brian Bendis as a team book writer is he doesn't find something for all the characters to do.
Yeah.
And I don't think he's really trying, to be fair to him. I don't think he's really necessarily interested in doing that. But,
It's interesting that he then writes so many team books.
Yeah, he's so much better at writing comics about solo characters.
Yeah, I mean, over the last couple of years... I mean, Moon Knight, I bought issue two of that, and I was still quite enjoyed it. Scarlet was... I mean, it's okay. It's better than a lot of his recent stuff. I know it's damning with fame praise to say it's okay. It wasn't really my kind of thing. But Ultimate Spider-Man, obviously, was one of the greatest things that he's done, and his Daredevil run was great as well.
The other reason, to be fair to Marvel, why you're not going to get much stuff being launched in September is because they're still in the middle of Fear itself. And conventional wisdom at Marvel for several years now has been that you launch all the new titles coming out of a crossover. Consequently, they'd probably have been holding back new books for a couple of months anyway, even without DC. There are 21 Fear itself tie-in comics in September. From the sales figures for the first month of tie-in books, I have to say that, I mean, they're going up a little bit, but not a huge amount. I think a lot of people are probably in the same position that I'm in with Fear itself, which is I'm buying the main series not because I actually want to read it, but because I have a nagging feeling that if I don't read it, then other books I already buy will become incomprehensible. I don't care at all about the crossover. I'm not picking up any of the tie-in books other than the ones I would have bought anyway. I bought Homefront number one on the grounds that there was a Peter Milligan story in it, and it wasn't very good, so I didn't pick up the rest.
There it is.
But you know, I think that's probably the where Fear itself is. People are buying that main miniseries because they feel they have to in order to follow the line, but they're not interested in picking up other other tie-ins. Spider-Island, also some one-shots coming out. Spider-Woman, Avengers.
There's decent creators. Fred Van Lenting, Giuseppe Camicoli on a Spider-Woman one-shot. Chris Yost and Mike McCone on what's been called an Avengers one-shot, but it's pretty much a Frogman thing. And one called I Love New York by Greg Rucka, Kelly Sue DeConnick, Joe Caramagna, Scotty Young, and Max Fiermara.
I have to admit, when you look at the creators who are working on Spider Island, when you just look at all the creators on all the time books, you do think it's got to be better than the premise makes it sound.
Well, I think I'm probably going to enjoy Spider Island a lot more than I'm enjoying some of the Fear Itself stuff.
Oh, God,
yes. Some of the Fear Itself things have been almost perfectly pitched at me. You know, there's that Fearsome Four series. It's got Man-Thing, which is a character I've always had a soft spot for. I love his old horror stuff. Howard the Duck, similarly. I love the Gerber stuff. And there have been some good Howard stories in recent years. Ty Templeton did a good series. She-Hulk, similarly. And Nighthawk, and I'm a big Defenders fan. And Frankenstein's Monster as well. Just a bit strange. And I bought the first issue of that, and it is appalling.
Really?
Absolutely dreadful.
Who's
rubbish.
It by?
Brandon Montclair and three artists. But I mean, the artists are like Kaluta and Bisley and guys like that. But it's just a bad, bad book.
I mean, Fear itself, unfortunately, has been an absolute train wreck. I expect Spider Island to be better. Because I think, frankly, the people working on it on the core story there have got much stronger storytelling instincts. Ultimate Comics.
Yeah, two more Ultimate launches.
The Ultimate relaunch already started in August, so Marvel couldn't really hold that one off for a month. Ultimate Comics Spider-Man starts over from issue one for the second time.
It has many years.
Ultimate Comics. No, it's been a little longer than that, to be fair.
Since the...
Yeah, cause it renumbered to 150 last year. It was renumbered to issue one about 2 years ago.
Yeah, so twice in as many years as twice in 2 years.
That works, right, actually. Ultimate Comics X-Men is being brought back. I don't know what's happening with Ultimate Comics X, which still ships, you know, once a quarter or so. I assume it'll get its first collection out and then be quietly forgotten about.
Well, I do hope so. I mean, Jeff Loeb is busy doing the Marvel Telly stuff at the moment, and Art Adams has always had the attention span of a gnat anyway. So I don't imagine we'll get more than that first Ultimate Comics X arc, unless they're planning on publishing on a more achievable schedule, like every time Halley's Comet comes round, they'll put out an issue of Ultimate Comics X.
And my favourite subtitle of the year, John Carter, Princess of Mars.
John Carter, just felt like feeling a little special today. Roger Langridge, Philippe Andrade and Scotty Young doing adaptations of the John Carter stories into comics.
There is a John Carter novel called A Princess of Mars, and that's why they're publishing a comic called John Carter, Princess of Mars. But it is an unfortunate title.
I just want to see him in like a tiara and like a big ball gown with a gun. New Avengers 16.1 we'll mention very briefly because it's pegging itself as being the start of the build-up to next year's crossover, so, you know.
Although since next year's crossover is the New Avengers versus Hammer, and the entire previous storyline was about the New Avengers versus Hammer, quite what's actually starting here, I've no idea.
It's apparently the build-up to the return of the Dark Avengers, because we apparently have learned nothing.
Okay.
Neil Adams draws it. Yeah.
Casanova, that gets its third miniseries from Icon. The key point is that this will be it resuming original stories and not just revised reprints.
Mm-hmm.
I dropped it after the first arc, frankly, and nothing that Matt Fraction has written in the last few years makes me think I want to read anything more by him.
I have been looking forward to Casanova Avarices since it was announced. I adore Casanova. I think every time I read an issue of Casanova, I am blown away by it. And I am absolutely overjoyed at the fact that this series is coming out.
I think, to be fair, that the first Casanova arc, I kind of see what people liked about it, but it wasn't for me. I found it a bit... It's big on ideas, it's big on flash, it's kind of emotionally hollow. I didn't like it, and that's when I thought Matt Fraction was actually in his prime. Given that I think Matt Fraction's spectacularly lost the plot in the last year or so, I'm really not interested in this comic. But, you know, if you're of the view that maybe Matt Fraction on creative-owned books will get his act back together, here it is.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the emotional moments in Casanova are definitely buried underneath all the flash and the style. But the
boy, are they buried!
But they're not really buried that far when the characters are established, particularly in the second miniseries. There are a lot more.
I didn't last that long.
Well, there you go then. It's there. You just haven't read it. We're going to go on to do the DC number ones, and we're going to try and just batter through the DC number ones. I've not written all these out. I'm just going to run through them on the screen here.
Yeah, we spoke about some of these last episode, so we'll try and skim over some of those. Justice League number one, Geoff Johns and Jim Lee, we spoke about before. Yep. That's obviously the huge one. That's the linchpin of the relaunch. That's everyone's going to be buying.
We should say whether we're on board for these books as well, because you've done yours on the blog, but people may not have read that, and I've not done mine. So, Justice League, yay or nay?
Yes.
It will be the keystone of the line, I'm quite sure. Justice League International. Dan Jurgens and Aaron Lopresti. Dan Jurgens writing... he did do this roster, well, a similar roster to this, of the Justice League back in the day when it was the Bwahaha era.
No, Dan Jurgens is not a guy who particularly excites me as a creator. I think he's competent, but you know, with 52 books out there, am I going to buy a Dan Jurgens comic? Nah.
I'll try the first issue. I'm much more wary about it now than when I thought it was going to be Judd Winnick.
Aquaman by Geoff Johns, Ivan Weiss and Joe Prado. I'll try it. I don't much care for Aquaman, but I'll try it to see, you know, what he makes of it.
I'm actually not even probably going to bother trying it. I was going to try it, and then I realised just how little I care about Aquaman. He's a guy who's just been messed around so much over the past 5 years or so.
Which in a way makes him a character who might actually benefit from just having a Scorched Earth reboot.
Yeah.
You just say, yeah, all of that stuff that messed him around, yeah, forget it. We'll start from scratch. Clean slate.
Yep. Wonder Woman by Brian Azzarello and Cliff Chiang. Mentioned before, Brian Azzarello and Cliff Chiang did Doctor 13. It was superb. I am so down for this. As long as Cliff Chiang is working on this book, I'll be there for it.
I'll try it. I'm curious to see how those creators work together on a book like Wonder Woman, because it doesn't seem like a natural match for them, but I'm intrigued. The Flash, this again is one we spoke about before, Francis Manapole and Brian Buccellato. I liked Manapole's work on this book. I'm maybe in a minority on that. I agree that he's maybe not best suited for The Flash, but I like his art. I'll try it.
I probably won't. I mean, to be honest, Barry Allen is such a turn-off for me in a Flash book. Where is Wally West?
Do we know that this actually is Barry Allen in the relaunched Flash?
Yeah.
Captain
Atom by J.T. Krull and Freddie Williams. Well, that's...
No.
That definitely exists.
The Fury of Firestorm, number one. Ethan Van Sciver and Gail Simone writing art by Yildiray Senar.
The man who's possibly an anagram. Yeah, I'll get that. Gail, I would follow to most things, and I will emphasise most because we'll be coming on to another one later on. I've never read anything that Ethan Van Sciver has written, but Sinar's art is not bad.
I think anything with Gail Simone co-writing has got to be worth a look.
Mm-hmm. Back to J.T. Krull's little corner of DC with Green Arrow. A Green Arrow, a character that I think has got a lot of potential, but just, I mean, for a guy who's supposed to be this real reactionary, he's very boring.
Yeah, not interested in that reactionary. Green Arrow?
Yeah, he's supposed to be totally like, oh, come and set fire to your government buildings, or similar.
That's not reactionary, that's the opposite of reactionary, isn't it?
Depends what you're reacting against. Okay. He's supposed to be a guy who goes off on one, but he doesn't really.
The Savage Hawkman, number one, by Tony Daniel and Philip Tan. We covered this before, neither of us was interested.
No, it's almost bottom of my list. Mr. Terrific by Eric Wallace and Roger Robinson. The only real evidence of the JSA existing at all is this Mr. Terrific book. JSA fans may be interested in it. Eric Wallace's Titans got sufficiently bad notices that I'm really not that bothered about this book.
It does seem odd that they're not using the Justice Society of America, but in some ways I'm quite pleased that they're not just shoving in all of the books that never get cancelled just for the sake of having them there. And who knows, maybe they're leaving some stuff so that they can launch in December or January.
Yeah, and John said to say that they are resting the JSA for a bit, but they're not abandoning it.
Yeah. DC Universe Presents, number one, Paul Jenkins and Bernard Chang. This is actually a Dead Man storyline. It sounds like DC Universe Presents is basically a series of miniseries, but without the advantage of having a fresh number one every five issues. Paul Jenkins hasn't, I think, been particularly on form the last few years.
Flip a coin, which Paul Jenkins is going to turn up to work today?
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'm not down for this. Action Comics by Grant Morrison and Rags Morales. I could take or leave it. Kidding. Yeah, I'm going to be buying this comic. Absolutely. Grant Morrison doing Superman, that is pretty much the definition for me of a no-brainer.
That's a certainty. Superman number one, George Perez writing and at least doing the breakdowns with full art by Jesus Marino.
Yeah, Marino is Carlos Pacheco's usual inker, but he's also not a bad pencil artist himself. To be honest, he's the more attractive thing about this title for me than George Perez writing, because Perez has written books for extended runs before. He did a Wonder Woman run, which is solid, but it's not very exciting.
Well, I'll give it a shot. I've not actually seen much of George Perez's writing. I'm interested enough to see what he can do with it.
Superboy by Scott Lobdell and R.B. Silva. This is a bit of a difficult one for me, because Scott Lobdell on Superboy is, you know, it's not a character that I've got any great affinity for. Jeff Lemire got me reading his stuff, but that's because it was, you know, beautifully drawn and really well written. Scott Lobdell in conjunction with Superboy, yeah, no, not so much. But it's drawn by R.B. Silva, who was the artist on the Jimmy Olsen stuff that Nick Spencer did. And he's a really very, very good artist.
I will pass on this. I'm not really interested in these low-end family member books.
I'll see what the reviews are like. Maybe pick it up later.
Supergirl by Michael Green, Mike Johnson and Mahmoud Azrar.
Azrar's art I like. I don't really know who Green and Johnson are.
I've never heard of them.
Have I heard of them? The manufacturers?
I'll probably be told now that we've reviewed them at some point.
Probably.
The names don't ring out. The names don't immediately strike me as familiar. I'm not interested in that. And to be fair, Supergirl I've never been interested in. I'm not sure I've ever bought a Supergirl comic.
I used to buy Peter David's Supergirl. I enjoyed that at the time. Batman, Scott Snyder and Greg Capullo. Scott Snyder, I've not actually read his Batman stuff, but he's had absolutely corking reviews all over the internet for his stuff.
I'll try this.
I don't know about Capullo. His work on Haunt was not what you would call good, but...
It was all right. It was very School of Todd McFarlane. I think one of the things with Greg Capullo is he needs to find his own voice again.
Yeah, away from the inks of McFarlane as well, because it was McFarlane was still inking over Capullo for most of Capullo's work for him.
Detective Comics, number one, Tony Daniel and Ryan Wynn. I'm not really interested in Tony Daniel writing Batman.
Yeah, this is the legacy of Detective Comics, Tony Daniel writing and drawing it. Yeah. Batwing, issue one, written by Judd Winnick, art and cover by Ben Oliver. Africa, the dark continent. It's one big homogenous place and one man protects all of it.
Yes.
We're going to be seeing Batwing, I think, doing a lot of commuting, just catching a lot of trains, a lot of short-haul flights, a lot of long-haul flights.
Yeah, the Batwing, the Batman of Africa. That, to me, sets the alarm bells ringing.
Yeah, everything from Marrakesh to Johannesburg.
But I'm perversely intrigued by this because it sounds like such a train wreck that I think it's almost worth picking up to see how badly wrong it can go. I know that's not maybe why I meant to want to buy it, but...
it is the absolute definition of underdog title as well, because it's
oh,
like
no, wait till
brand
we get
new character, black character,
set abroad, junior end of the family,
exactly, writer who divides fandom, artist who is not a huge name. This is going to be one of these books that's got its work really, really cut out for it. Batman The Dark Knight, issue 1, written by David Finch, art by David Finch, has already been put back to December.
Really?
Apparently, so I heard.
So they're only shipping 51 books? And
I believe so. See, I saw this on message board. I haven't been able to find a source for it. Take that with a pinch of salt. But whoever it was certainly seemed to think that it had been announced that it had been put back to December.
Well, the bottom line is, David Finch's Batman I didn't care about when it was first announced. I don't care about it now.
Yeah, I won't miss it.
Batman and Robin number 1. Peter Tomasi and Patrick Gleason and Mick Gray.
It's actually the first book we're going to have Bruce and Damian as Batman and Robin. Because
really?
When
because
Damian became Robin, it was at the launch of the last Batman and Robin book, which was when Dick had just taken over doing it.
All very interesting, but, you know, again, I'm not interested in picking up a range of Batman titles.
Yeah.
There is space in my wallet for maybe one Batman title to try out. I'm not going to try the entire line. Batgirl 1, Gail Simone, Adrian Syah, Vicente Cifuentes. This is controversial because this is Barbara Gordon being put back in the Batgirl role. I would like it if the new Oracle turned out eventually to be a fat bloke from Edinburgh.
A fat 40-year-old American at Edinburgh University. He's proved to actually be Oracle. This whole time, Barbara wasn't even doing the Oracle job. It was just this fat 40-year-old guy, and now he has to be Batgirl.
That'd be quite fun, actually. Actually, no, you could do something with the idea of having Oracle still around and do a question of, you know,
is it
still the same character? Is Barbara Gordon both of them?
I wouldn't have minded seeing that, actually. Barbara getting the use of her legs back but still being Oracle. That would have been interesting. You know where I said that there were some places I wouldn't follow Gail? I won't follow her to Batgirl, because I have absolutely no affinity for Barbara as Batgirl. Barbara's Batgirl was 23 years ago, and even then she'd only appeared about half a dozen times in the previous 6 years. It was only with The Killing Joke that she really came back to the DCU in any way at all.
I agree, and I think Gail Simone's got a major uphill struggle to sell people on this comic, but in a way that's actually what makes me interested in it. I'm going to buy this not because I think it's a good idea necessarily, but because I want to see what Gail Simone does with it, and I'm interested to see. I think if anyone can make this work, Gail Simone can.
Yeah, it's going to lose me, unfortunately.
Batwoman. J.H. Williams III and Hayden Blackman. This was announced earlier in the year and it's been pushed back to September.
Yes.
And obviously a yes for both of
us. Yes, please.
Nightwing 1, Kyle Higgins and Eddie Barrows and J.P. Mayer. Nightwing?
I liked Dick Grayson. I actually thought that Dick as Batman was a really interesting character because he was much more... He was still Dick Grayson. He was a kind of devil-may-care acrobat guy, which was a totally different style of Batman. Going back to being Nightwing seems like something of a retrograde step, but you never know. Kyle Higgins, bless him, he is the man who is taking on a lot of difficult assignments, both at Marvel and DC. He's the guy that's bringing Supreme Power back as well at Marvel, after Howard Chaykin took it out the back and shot it twice in the back of the head.
Catwoman, number 1, Judd Winnick and Guillaume March. I don't care about Catwoman.
It's actually kind of gross. Firstly, there's that skeevy cover, the unbelievable, like, it had better come laminated because it's obviously designed to be wiped clean. And
to be fair,
the solicitation of it. I mean, Catwoman, she's addicted to the night, addicted to shiny objects, addicted to Batman. Like, at what point has that really been an accurate description of Catwoman in the past 10 years?
Well,
since the Brubaker relaunch, how has this been an accurate... I just think...
Well, it may be an accurate description of her post the reboot, I don't know.
It's because it's another step back for another character, for another female character as well.
Yeah, well, I mean, in fairness to DC, on the whole, they do seem to be redesigning a lot of the costumes in a way that makes them less obnoxious than they were before. But yeah, this is...
Catwoman's the exception, definitely.
Her and Harley Quinn. Birds of Prey.
Yeah. We'll come to the Harley Quinn thing later.
Birds of Prey, number 1, by Dwayne Szczesny and Jesus Saiz. Not interested. I'd buy that book because of Gail Simone. I'm not that concerned about seeing Dwayne Szczesny try and take them on. He wrote Cable for a while. and I thought it was okay.
Yeah, he wrote Iron Fist, and it was not bad. But with this many books, not bad is really not good enough. Although, interestingly and amusingly, Katana on the front cover of that book does look like she's trying to have a wee without getting any on her shoes.
Red Hood and the Outlaws, number one, Scott Lobdell and Kenneth Rocafort. I quite like Kenneth Rocafort's art. He's one of the top cow house guys, but okay. Does some quite good colouring work.
Lobdell on a book with Jason Todd and Arsenal in it.
Red Hood and the Outlaws?
No.
Green Lantern 1, Geoff Johns, Doug Mankey and Christian Alamy. This is just a continuation of a series I'm not buying at the moment.
Yeah,
I don't intend to.
I'm looking for a point to leap off the Green Lantern books, and I think I pretty much have found it. Green Lantern Corps, similarly for me. If I want to read a Guy Gardner book, then I think I'll probably stick to the one that's not linked to three other comics, which would be JLI.
And the same goes with Green Lantern, New Guardians, Tony Bedard, Tyler Kirkman, Bat.
It's a shame, because Bedard does space stuff well. It's where his forte lies, I think, is cosmic stuff.
Red Lanterns, number one. Peter Milligan, Ed Benison, Rob Hunter. With great hesitation, I'm going to try this because it's Peter Milligan, but I expect it to be terrible.
Okay, strike one against it, it's Red Lanterns, who are just ridiculous. Strike two, it's part of the Green Lantern milieu. I think if you're reading this and you're not reading the other three Green Lantern books, you're going to be getting 25% of the story. And strike three is it's Ed Bennis, whose art I have really, really disliked for a very long time. It was bad on Birds of Prey, it's just bad on Justice League, it's bad in general.
I think you're probably right, but it's Peter Milligan, so I'll give it a chance.
Speaking of
not
Peter
much
Milligan.
Of a chance, but it'll get a first issue. Yeah. Ah, yes, Peter Milligan, Mikhail Janin on Justice League Dark.
The worst named book in the whole life.
Somebody said it sounded like a guest ale.
It does, or a spicy chocolate.
I'll have a pint of Justice League Dark, please.
John Constantine, Dead Man, Shade the Changing Man, Zatanna, Enchantress and Madame Xanadu. An interesting group of characters, and if anybody can do it, it's Milligan.
Enchantress is the villain.
Mm-hmm.
She's not in the team. But
she's on the cover.
Yeah, but Shade and John Constantine, written by Peter Milligan. I'm up for that.
Yep.
Milligan's been doing really good work on Hellblazer the last few years, which has gone largely unnoticed. Mm-hmm. To be honest, I wouldn't have been that surprised if they just folded Hellblazer back into the DC Universe, because he's not doing much in it that couldn't be done in a regular DC Universe title.
Mm-hmm.
He's just doing it very well.
Swamp Thing. Now, I think I probably will get this, even though I don't really have any affinity for Swamp Thing outside of Alan Moore's stories, and I'm slightly wary anytime a Swamp Thing series is launched that it's just going to be an homage to Alan Moore. But Scott Snyder writing it and Yannick Paquette drawing it, yeah, I'll give that a go.
I've never really cared about Swamp Thing. Animal Man number one, Jeff Lemire, Trevor Foreman and Dan Green.
I'm
going to try the other Jeff Lemire book, which is Frankenstein Agent of Shade, Jeff Lemire, Alberto Ponticelli.
Yeah, one of my favourite, well, in fact, my absolute favourite character from Seven Soldiers.
This is one that's going to be a tough sell, and we're getting now into the books that are, yeah, these books are not going to be in the top 100 come issue three, but it depends how dedicated DC are to these and how many of these they see as having the potential life in the bookstores, foreign licensing, digital.
Yeah.
You never know. I, Vampire, Joshua Hill, Fialkov and Andrea Sorrentino.
Fialkov's Elk's Run was okay. It started well, ended much more weakly than it began. Not really that interesting vampire story, though, I have to say.
Me neither. Resurrection Man, number one, Dan Abnett, Andy Lanning, Fernando Danino. I do like Abnett and Lanning's work in the last few years, but I never much cared for Resurrection Man the first time round.
I really enjoyed it the first time round, and I'm very much looking forward to seeing them do it again. I'm on for this.
Demon Knights, number one, Paul Cornell, Diogenes Nevis, and Eclair Albert. This is set in the Dark Ages and stars Madame Xanadu, Jason Blood, and Etrigan. I think it's going to be dead within a year, but I mean, that is the definition of a tough sell. Madame Xanadu and Etrigan set in the Dark Ages?
Yeah.
But I.
Good creators working on it.
Good creators. It'll probably be a good comic. It'll probably be a good miniseries. I mean, I'll buy it. I just don't have any faith in it staying around longer than a year.
I honestly, good creators, but I'm going to skip it. I just don't like Etrigan enough.
Stormwatch, Paul Cornell, Miguel Sepulveda. Stormwatch are back, and they've now got the Martian Manhunter and also Midnight of and Apollo. So it's it's obviously an attempt to integrate them into the DC universe.
Yeah. I don't know exactly what purpose Apollo and the Midnighters serve in the DCU when they're supposed to be reflections of Superman and Batman.
I don't know. Yes, that's an interesting point. I'll try this. It's Paul Cornell. Yeah. Somebody pointed this out, though. I think it was on Bleeding Cool, pointing out that there is a sign already of the left hand not knowing what the right hand's doing. It says in the solicitation, directly following the ominous events of Superman 1, right?
Yeah.
This book goes on sale September the 7th.
Yep,
and Superman 1 is September the 25th.
Yes.
Voodoo, number one. Ron Mars and Sammy Basri. This is just reviving
Wildcat character, Voodoo.
Don't see it.
Yeah, not really interested.
Grifter, Nathan Edmondson and Carfu. I changed my mind on this, actually. I'm going to buy this. Because, first of all, Nathan Edmondson is writing Who is Jake Ellis?
Yes, which is very good. And Carfu and Bit drawing Thunder Agents. The art is amazing.
And they've given Grifter the premise of Rom.
The premise of Rom?
Yeah. The premise.
Oh, yes! I see. Now, yeah, it's basically a diurething, isn't it?
That's exactly what it is.
He's hunting, exterminating inhuman creatures hidden in human form.
The idea is that everyone thinks he's a serial killer because he's going around killing humans who he knows are disguised aliens, which was exactly the premise of the first year or so of Rom.
Oh.
I mean, literally, exactly the premise of the first year or so of Rom. The idea was that Rom would wander around killing people who he knew would die of AIDS, wouldn't explain his actions, and everybody thought he was a mad killer robot.
Fair enough. Deathstroke, Kyle Higgins, Joe Bennett. Deathstroke, the very definition of something which has been run into the ground. I don't know how much more they can destroy the character.
Care.
Suicide Squad, Adam Glass and Marco Rodino. Now, you were saying you hadn't heard of the creative team, so you weren't on board for this. Adam Glass is one of the writers and producers on the TV show Supernatural, and he's a very good writer for that.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I haven't read any comics that he's done. And with the terrible look that they've given Harley Quinn and the fact that it's an artist who I don't really know, no, not for me, I don't think.
OMAC, number one, Dan DiDio and Keith Giffen. Dan DiDio? No.
Dan DiDio and Keith Giffen. Now, this is what you call good idea, bad idea.
Keith Giffen's patchy at any rate. I'm not interested in anything that Dan DiDio's writing.
I like Giffen's art a lot still. I just no interest in Dan DiDio's writing.
Black Hawks 1, Mike Koster and Ken Lashley.
What if we made Black Hawks into G.I. Joe?
No. Men of War, number 1, Ivan Brandon and Tom Devenick. This is Sergeant Rock and Easy Company, but in the present day.
I'm quite interested in this. Ivan Brandon's a very good writer, and I actually quite like Tom Derenick's art, and the thought of taking a DCU war comic, I'm interested in this.
Actually, I think the time may be right to revive the war comic.
Mm.
All-Star Western, number one, Justin Gray, Jimmy Palmiotti, and Moritat.
Moritat, who has been absolutely kicking ass on Elephant Men, really, really great artist. Gray and Palmiotti, on various projects, I've run hot and cold on them. Their Jonah Hex is dependably solid to good.
Yeah, I'm not a Western fan, but I think basically if you like Jonah Hex, you'll like this.
Mm.
Teen Titans number one, Scott Lobdell, Brett Booth and Norm Rapmond. Not interested.
A comic that's fallen through a time warp from 1994. I think I've seen this one being written up in Wizard's Hot List.
Static Shock number one, Scott McDaniel, John Rosen and Jonathan Glapion.
Yeah, John Rosen's zombie appears to be gone, which is a shame but not surprising given the sales it was getting. McDaniel's art is always good, and seeing the two of them together on Static, who's a character I really like.
Probably worth a look.
I'll get that.
Hawk and Dove by Sterling Gates and Rob Liefeld.
Poor Sterling Gates. I mean, Sterling Gates has been getting great reviews for his Supergirl work, but I mean, to be saddled with Rob Liefeld on Hawk and Dove.
It's going
to
be terrible.
No
matter how good the script is, it's going to look awful. Mm. Blue Beetle, number one. Tony Bedard, Ig Guara, Roy Jose. I like Blue Beetle, the character. I like Tony Bedard. This is worth a look,
I think. I'll get this.
Legion of Superheroes, number one. Paul Levitz, Francis Portela. That's basically the same existing series continuing.
If you like Legion, then you'll be up for that. I'm not a huge Legion fan, but
Legion Lost, Fabian Asieda and Pete Woods. I like that creative team.
Yes, me too. Also, it's not the sort of big numbers of the Legion's teams either. I mean, there are some kind of B-list Legionnaires in there, Wildfire and Gates and guys like that, but it's not, you know, it's not Cosmic Boy and Mon-El. And that's the 52. That's the 52 DC books. Thanks for sticking with us through that.
Happy editing, Al.
I'm not cutting anything out of that. We'll move on to our comics reviews, though.
What should we start with?
15 Love is the top.
Let's start with 15 Love. This is by Andy Watson, Tommy Otsuka, with colours by Guru EFX. This is a comic which has been...
Talk about comics falling through a time warp.
Well, exactly. I mean, supposedly what happened was when Marvel recently moved offices or did some sort of office shuffle or something, a whole load of unpublished material was found at the back of a cupboard, pretty much, which is why we're now getting these from the Marvel Vault story.
Yes, which have been interesting inventory issues, really, just kind of a look into what was happening at the time.
15 Love is a miniseries which was commissioned back in the Bill Gemmis days.
It was to be part of the second wave of the Tsunami titles.
And there never was a second wave.
Well, there was a second wave, but some of them weren't published, and one of the ones that wasn't published was 15 Love.
And this is a romance comic. Officially it's a romance comic.
Well,
but in
it's a tennis comic.
Yes, exactly. You'd expect it from the title to be a romance comic, given that it's a revival of Millie Collins. This is actually her nephew, also called...
Her niece. Who's very feminine. This is a totally different type of manga.
This is this is her niece, also called Millie Collins. Who is at a tennis academy. For the fact that it's called 15 Love, you might assume it's going to be a romance comic, but no, it's a tennis manga.
Yeah, I mean, tennis mangas, I mean, there are tennis mangas. You know, this is not just a genre that Marvel has invented. It's a thing that does exist. But it's not a thing that is, you know, one of the big American successes for manga. It's not kids blasting things out of their hands or anything.
They've boldly chosen to revive a character very few people under the age of 50 care about.
And put it in a genre that nobody buys in America would buy. That is ballsy. You can see why it was put at the back of the cupboard.
It's quite good, actually. I mean, it is what it is. It's a tennis manga about a struggling teenage tennis player in need of a new coach.
Yes, when you read it, though, what you remember is that it's an Andy Watson comic and is therefore really well written.
It is.
But I picked this up thinking, oh man, this is an extra long issue. Oh, I'm going to have to read this whole blooming tennis comic. And by the end of it, I was like, oh, when's the next issue coming out? I need to find out what happens.
It is exactly what you think it's going to be, but it's very well done. It's a nice looking book.
The characters are, although there are very few of them in the book, there are maybe half a dozen characters. They all get a decent bit of the positioning in the story. Some of them are very clearly just the supporting characters. You know, you're not getting her best mate fleshed out too much or anything like that. Your main characters are her tennis coach, her tennis coach's girlfriend or wife, and her arch enemy. With a bit of play in there from her aunt as well. Millie Collins, by the way, if you are a fan of the original Millie Collins, then
does appear in
the nurse will be round soon. We're playing Scrabble this afternoon. Do you want me to put the telly on? The telly. Okay. Yeah, well, if you are a fan of the original Millie Collins...
She does appear in a couple of pages.
But she's kind of a bitch, though, isn't she?
Yes.
Like, they've made her into a real monster. I don't think that necessarily she was like that in the original stories, but to be honest, it doesn't matter what the original stories were like. This is not, you know, it's technically the same character, but you're not going to get a lot of continuity throwbacks to 50-year-old romance comics from the Atlas era.
Millie the Model is in continuity, so presumably this is meant to be in continuity as well, but it doesn't matter.
In the second issue, she has to play against the Dark Avengers.
Yeah.
Norman Osborn's her new coach.
I can't know quite what to say about this. I mean, it's working in a genre that has virtually no commercial appeal. And if you are interested in tennis comics, presumably you've already bought a lot of the imported and unofficially translated Japanese ones.
Yeah, Prince of Tennis or whatever.
It's the sort of thing that would actually, in some ways, have been somewhat at home in the Minx imprint.
Yeah, it would actually. I mean, but Minx, I suppose, was designed to be...
It's skewing a little younger, I think.
Well, than some of the Minx ones, yeah. The Minx was an interesting imprint because it had titles which went backwards and forwards between the different age ranges. You know, New York 4 is not the same kind of thing that you would give to somebody who was interested in Good as Lily or Regifters or whatever.
Yeah, that was part of the problem with the imprint. That I mean, New York 4, in many ways, a good series. But the fact that you could take this comic, which was designed for an imprint targeted at teenage girls, and then put it in Vertigo, where it looked a bit more at home, to be honest, it kind of shows that there was a certain lack of focus in what Minx was actually about. It was unified by a sort of vague aspiration that there was a massive untapped market of teenage girls wanting to buy indie comics, basically.
Yeah, well, I suppose if you never try to sell the comics to the market, then you never find out whether or not you can do it. And if you have this potential audience out there, by definition, you don't have them already, and so you don't know what they like. So trying a variety of different things to see what sells and then doing more of that kind of thing probably would have worked, but Minx just didn't get long enough to find its audience. I mean, when you're playing Minesweeper for your audience, essentially, you have to hit it once or twice first, and you're not going to do that immediately.
I think that's right. I think there was a degree of pious aspiration that this is material that everybody would absolutely love if only it was out there.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure that was the commercial appeal of some of that material was necessarily as broad as DC were hoping.
Anyway, we digress.
This is probably, in many ways, actually ought to be a lot more marketable because it's trying to be as mainstream a tennis comic as a tennis comic in North America could be. Mm-hmm.
I just worry that the direct market is not kitted out to handle a book from Marvel that's a tennis comic with no superhero elements, drawn in an extremely, I don't want to say in a manga style because that's so reductive.
It's not really that much of a manga style. It's a manga-influenced style. It's halfway between manga and US.
It depends on which mangas you're reading, to be honest, because there certainly are... less read mangas, but I've certainly seen animes that are very much in this visual style. So it's not the kind of thing that comic shops are set up to know how to order, I don't think. And on that basis, I think they will order it very, very low.
No, I think more accurately, comic shops do know how to order this. They know exactly how many copies of this they'll sell, which is that they'll sell it to the hardcore Andy Watson fan base and the people who bought Minx Digests. I think the natural home of this story is in the digest format.
Mm-hmm.
But the problem for Marvel is they don't have a range of digests in which they can promote this, and Marvel sticking this book out on its own, hunting for an audience for tennis comics made 4 years ago.
It's longer. 2002, I think, this was commissioned.
Has it been on the shelf
2003?
Yeah. Oh, God. Just seeing if there's a copyright warning on this, but now, of course, they take the copyright warning from publication date in America, don't they?
Yeah, not from when it was actually made.
I think it's better than you're probably imagining. It's going to get lost.
It is, and that's a shame, because it's well-drawn, very well written, entertaining, and it's the kind of thing that actually so few comics now get to a stage at the end of the issue where you go, oh, what's going to happen next time round? I really want to read what happens next. And this has got a great last page, which kind of subverts slightly the way I thought they were going to go with it. I'm looking forward to reading the rest of this series. So that's 15 Love, moving on.
Graveyard of Empires, Mark Sabor and Paul Azaceta. This is, I assume it's a miniseries from Image.
Mm-hmm.
What this is a zombie comic set in Afghanistan.
Mm.
Now, I have to say, that is not a premise that appealed to me.
It does seem slightly like, I mean, zombies are I suppose zombies are the kind of thing that you can do as metaphor very, very easily. They lend themselves very well to that. But over the last few years, particularly in comics, zombies has become a kind of a thing that should always have an exclamation mark at the end and probably be followed by the words ninjas, pirates, robots, monkeys and dinosaurs.
I think you're right. I think that's maybe my concern. My immediate reaction when I saw the pitch for this and the solicitations was, oh, that's going to be incredibly tacky.
mm-hmm.
in a way that's kind of uncomfortable when there are people still out there in Afghanistan being killed.
Mm-hmm.
And I didn't order this from the when it was solicited, and I looked at it again when the shipping this week list, and I thought, should I get that? I should get issue one of something to review. I thought, no, I really don't have any interest in that.
So and it then, missed the cut twice then.
Yeah, and then when I looked at what actually came in my parcel for this week, I thought, I really do have to buy something else to review. And I popped into Forbidden Planet in Glasgow because I was through there and bought this because it was an issue one that came out this week. And do you know what? It's actually quite good.
Yeah, Mark Sable, you may remember him from being the guy who was detained by the TSA because of a book that he had written. He also wrote a Teen Titans miniseries at the tail end of last year, which was mostly notable for the fact that it had Sean Murphy on art. But this is the first time where he's really gotten to show, I think, what he can properly do in comics, because, to be honest, random Teen Titans miniseries, yeah, whatever.
What this is basically a group of American soldiers at an outpost in Afghanistan. Mm-hmm. Who, as always in these things, over the course of the first issue, get cut off and find themselves as a group of people under siege.
Yeah, they're not getting their evac comes halfway through the issue to bring them a new commanding officer after the commanding officer gets killed, and then they're told there isn't going to be another evac for how long was it? 2 weeks or something like that. They're told.
So they're on their own. It's in many ways the classic setup that there's a small group of characters surrounded by a load of people. And in some ways, part of the idea, I think, is that the characters start off kind of seeing the locals as a faceless horde who they can't interact with anyway. They've got one translator, and he spends some of the issue complaining that because they never leave the compound, he's completely useless to them because he never gets anyone to talk to.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and the basic thing about it is that the zombies turn up at the end. Not a huge spoiler. You're kind of expecting that from a zombie comic about, you know, Afghanistan war. But the metaphor in the middle of it is not just about the fact that there are a lot of people dying in Afghanistan. That's a fairly kind of obvious thing. You know, it's actually one of the things that generates the plot. But I think that the thing that we're trying to take away from this, or at least that we're meant to take away from this, is the possibility that it's easy to see people who you can't communicate with or understand as being essentially a uniform wave of silent, implacable things which are coming to get you.
Yeah, and I mean, the book is quite keen to get across the message that these characters fundamentally just don't really understand the people mm-hmm. around them. Yes, some of these people are genuinely out to get them, so their concerns are not completely unfounded. I mean, it's quite nicely set up in the opening scene where the guy who is obviously, on one level, you know, a completely dangerous maniac and wants to ignore the rules of engagement and shoot people just because he thinks he can get away with it, mm-hmm. is nonetheless right that if they just stand there and wait for the guy walking slowly towards them to approach them because he's not carrying a visible gun, then he's going to blow them to smithereens because he's a suicide bomber. Mm. And, yeah, it's... At the same token, though, the way their understanding of the locals is, you know, flawed to the point of non-existent.
Mm-hmm.
But really, it's an issue that's mainly about setting up the core characters and giving them defined personalities and then creating a situation where things are starting to fall apart anyway, just as the zombies show up.
Yes.
This really shouldn't work, but strangely it does.
Yeah, I mean, the characters, as you say, are personality-wise quite well delineated. There's a lot of conflict potentially between them, which, you know, fans of Romero films will know is a great recipe for a zombie attack, is when you've got division within as well as without. My only thing with the characters in this is that Paul Azarkeyes's art is not sufficiently detailed for me to be able to tell many of them apart just by looking at them. There's
really?
There's the guy with the ginger beard.
Yes.
There's the black guy. There's the translator. In a couple of the panels, I couldn't tell whether I was supposed to be looking at the token woman or whether this was just a strangely drawn man. When the commanding officer comes in at the end of the issue, I didn't recognise that that was who he was meant to be until it was pointed out in dialogue. One of the characters gets bitten by a zombie at one point, and I was entirely unsure as to whether he was a character I was supposed to have seen before.
There are some clarity issues, I think, about some of the minor characters, mm-hmm. you're right. So, I think most of them are actually quite clear and distinct, but there are a couple who sort of blur together.
Mm-hmm.
And in fairness, you know, it's by definition, with a comic of this sort, you get a lot of people wearing the same clothes of similar
well, this
builds.
This is the problem, yeah.
But, I mean, I think he's trying, and I think for the most part he succeeds, but you're right, there are a couple of clarity bits.
Mm-hmm. As a comic that could have very easily been quite reductive and that could have been very insulting, really, to everyone involved, I think it's managed to get across a bit of nuance whilst at the same time setting up for what should hopefully be an exciting zombie base under siege story.
Absolutely. I mean, it sounds ridiculous to say that a comic about zombies in Afghanistan has nuance, but I think maybe a fairer way of putting it is it's not so much that it's subtle as that at least it's seeing every side of the argument,
mm-hmm.
and it's showing all the sides of the argument, and it's not taking sides between them.
One thing I would say as well, though, is if you're coming into this book looking for a sympathetic character, then good luck, because there really aren't many. They're either very
new commanding officer.
He's not really very sympathetic, is he?
He's broadly right, though.
Well, that doesn't make him sympathetic. He wants to go out and desecrate graves in order to find out information, and he at one point decides that he's going to allow his men to try to stop a landmine by digging a body out of the ground and bringing it over and dropping it on top of it to try to stop the thing from going off when the bloke moves his foot off it.
Well, to be fair, that's to get something. You can understand why he's doing that.
I can understand why he's doing it. It doesn't make him sympathetic.
Yeah.
Nobody in this book is particularly nice.
I think that's probably true.
It's difficult to know who to root for, is what I'm meaning. When everybody in it is kind of, at best, just hard-assed, and at worst, outright unpleasant. There doesn't seem to be a hero in this book.
Oh, there's certainly not an outright hero, but I think you're being a little harsh in saying all of the characters are just downright unpleasant.
They're not all just downright unpleasant. They're either downright unpleasant or they're unsympathetically hard. You know, the ones that are wanting to do the thing that they need to do, nobody in this book, I think, is doing anything because they think it's the right thing to do.
Maybe that's the point.
Yeah, well, I think it is the point, but that still remains the situation,
yes.
that
yes.
there is not a sympathetic character in the story.
I think,
whether or not it's by design.
I think that might emerge, though. I think that there are interesting characters in here, even if they're not necessarily sympathetic characters.
Mm-hmm.
And I think they can emerge over the course of the story. I'm actually thinking I might buy the rest of this mini now.
Yeah, I mean, I'll see whether I fancy buying the trade of it when it comes out. I did enjoy it, but as I say, given that I was unsure of who in this book I could actually root for, if all the characters in it died, I wouldn't be terribly disappointed. I would just be like, oh, okay, they died.
If all the characters died without going through some sort of development over the course of the story, I know what you mean. I think I have faith that this is heading somewhere. That's the thing, other than just being... There's more to this than just dumping the zombie plot in Afghanistan,
mm-hmm.
and saying, look, here's an amusing clash of genres.
Mm-hmm.
It clearly does have something it wants to say about the Afghan war and about...
Oh, absolutely. And it is a good book, and it is a good read. And if you let me know how it goes, then I maybe will pick up the trade of it. That's Graveyard of Empires. And moving on finally to Kirby Genesis from Dynamite, which is written by Kurt Busiek with art direction layouts by Alex Ross, art itself by Jack Herbert with occasional spot bits by Alex Ross.
Now, this is Dynamite having picked up from the Kirby Family Trust the rights to a whole load of later period Jack Kirby characters.
The whole Kirby created library, basically. Anything that was owned by him and not by another comics company.
Which obviously means, for the most part, the stuff he was doing later in his career after Marvel, after his stint at DC.
He was also creating stuff whilst he was working for them,
true.
A lot of the characters in this were never published in anything. They were just from his files. So they've had to be given personalities, etc., by Busek.
So, I mean, to what extent did Kirby actually intend for all of these characters to be in the same universe, let alone the same book?
I really don't think he did. I think he... His thing wasn't really, let's make everything one cohesive whole, because that implies, let's just keep doing more of the same and adding more onto this thing. Kirby was always a bit more of a guy who was like, well, I made a thing. That was good. Let's make another thing, you know?
Yeah, that's what I wonder. Is this necessarily the way in which he intended these characters to be seen? Did he have would he have wanted each character to be a freestanding concept to be developed its own way? What's the business the publishing plan rather that Dynamite have with these characters? Are they going to try and spin them off into their own titles?
I don't know. As far as I'm aware from the solicitations, there aren't any spin-offs for the first 3 or 4 months of it.
Right.
Dynamite have this terrible tendency though to take a project and spin it out to death. The Project Superpowers thing is the absolute perfect example of this. The last thing that Alex Ross was involved in, where it was him and Jim Kruger working together on this thing that was, you know, all the old Golden Age characters that was out of copyright, the Green Llama and the Death-Defying Devil and all that kind of thing. This, I hope they will keep it at least to this one comic for a while, but who knows how it'll go. The basic premise of this book is that there's a guy called Kirby who's a college student, and he's got a friend called Bobby who's a girl who he's mates with. And on one evening, a probe that was sent out by NASA in the 70s returns to Earth and brings with it all kinds of crazy characters from all over the place.
Does the probe actually return? I thought it was more that they've clearly seen the probe because they're impersonating the characters.
Yeah, no, the probe returns in... It's not shown in this issue, but it's in the Zero issue as the probe came back and what did it bring with it. It's not really important necessarily to have the probe itself in this issue because the probe is not like a character or anything, but if you read the Zero issue, then you get that little bit of extra information. If you don't, then it's not really that important.
The probe has prompted some weird stuff showing up on Earth.
Yeah.
Yeah, what this comes across as is it reminds me a bit of the New Universe launch, actually. It's the world outside your window until one day a event happens and then weird stuff starts cropping up all over the place. And that's kind of what Busiek's going for here, where a whole load of seemingly unrelated Jack Kirby concepts, including things that turn out to have been there for years but nobody's ever seen before, are suddenly dug up. And because there's no unifying theme to the characters beyond Kirby's style, he finds himself having to push the angle of here's our point of view character and here's the world being transformed and push that angle. And I think that kind of takes precedence, at least in this first issue, over getting over any of the individual Kirby concepts.
Yeah, I think this is definitely not an issue which is designed to explore any of these characters. It's designed to get an awful lot of pieces onto the board at once. So literally just get one page of characters like the Galaxy Green girls turn up, for example. And Silver Star gets about 2 panels. But there are plenty of characters being introduced and plenty of concepts being introduced. And in the hands of, I think, a lesser writer, this could have just been and then, and then, and then, and then, and then, like a child telling you the story.
And Busiek knows, which is why Busiek knows what he's doing and realises he can't set up all these concepts. He's got to do something else as the story in the first issue, and that's why we're getting the focus on Kirby and everything being turned upside down.
Mm-hmm.
And the Midnight Swan.
Midnight Swan, a existing design, I believe, but an entirely new character built around that existing design.
The Midnight Swan.
The Midnight Swan sounds, again, like a guest ale. Quite a dark beer, I think.
It does sound like a guest ale.
I'll have a pint of Midnight Swan and a packet of salt and vinegar McCoys, please.
Come to think of it, Graveyard of Empires sounds like a guest ale. The sort of thing Brewdog would make.
Yeah, exactly. It's like, oh, how much is that? Oh, 15, love. Yeah, so bunch of characters introduced in this issue. How they will fit together, we have no idea. How they will interact with each other, we have no idea. How they will interact with Kirby, the main character, we have no idea. But I can't help but thinking that Jack Kirby himself would probably have been quite entertained by the sheer number of ideas and concepts and characters that are thrown breathlessly onto the page, one after the other.
Yeah. No, it's. I think maybe what BZEC's going for is, here's a whole load of Jack Kirby ideas which you've never seen before, mm-hmm. or, you know, which are incredibly obscure and you've probably never
heard of. Yeah, Silver Star, I think, is probably the most famous of them all.
And we're now going to, and you're now going to get to explore them all. It is a good first issue in terms of setting that up. I think I'm still not wholly sold on the idea of a story where the entire premise is, here's a load of intellectual property we picked up from Jack Kirby's estate.
Yes.
Characters who weren't necessarily conceived of as being in the same story. I think that's my slight concern about it. They've been shoved in here together in a way that wasn't necessarily the original premise.
A lot of these characters, I think, didn't really have even necessarily an original premise. They had an original design and sometimes a name. Very few of them actually have much of a publishing history behind them.
Mm.
I think I'm probably going to keep getting this book because, firstly, the art is very nice. The guy who they've got into to do the artist is not one of the kind of Dynamite House style kind of guys who can come across quite sort of stagey and stiff. He's actually, ironically, much more of a Marvel-looking artist. It's the kind of thing that wouldn't be too out of place in the current Marvel lineup.
Yes, the art's not really going so much for Kirby pastiche. Actually, it looks
Tell you what it reminds me of is Neil Adams's layouts. Kind of diagonal panels and overlapping panels and so on. Adams did a lot of, particularly on his X-Men work.
It's somewhere between Neil Adams and Brent Anderson's work for Astro City.
It doesn't
look very Kirby, except in the character designs, but that's probably for the best,
mm-hmm.
because, you know, who really wants to read some poor artist doing a Jack Kirby pastiche for 22 pages?
Yeah, it would have been tempting to get somebody onto this book like Tom Scioli, who did Godland, who does a very good Kirby pastiche. But at that point, it would just have been the covers band in the corner of the bar. It wouldn't have been anything trying to make its own statement or its own mark.
Absolutely. I do like the fact that this book is clearly trying quite hard to sell us on the idea that these are interesting ideas,
mm-hmm.
that they're not just of interest because they come from the Jack Kirby vault,
mm-hmm.
that they're of interest in and of them, they're good ideas in and of themselves.
Yeah.
Now, how well developed any of those ideas actually were, I don't know, but I'm glad to see it being put that they're not simply coasting on or relying on the idea that Jack Kirby's shopping list merits a 4-issue miniseries.
Exactly.
Which, and I think a lot of people would have done, given this remit.
Yes, they're not trying to say, well, here's an issue of the Silver Star. Let's tell you about Silver Star and why he's important and why you should care about him. What they're doing is, here's an issue about this guy and his friend, and here's a lot of crazy stuff happening. Would you like to read more about the crazy stuff happening? And also, and this is the other reason why I'll be buying the rest of this, would you like to see Kurt Busiek given his own entire superhero universe to play with from scratch that is not Astro City, i.e. that's going to come out a bit more regularly?
Well, that's a point. That's a point. I mean, that said, Astro City has done it already.
Yes, I mean, Astro City has obviously been Kurt Busiek's own superhero universe from scratch, but it is so irregularly published that I, to be honest, I'm kind of jonesing for more.
I mean, it's because it's not particularly a Kirby pastiche, this actually reads like more of a Kurt Busiek comic,
mm-hmm.
than a Jack Kirby comic. Mm-hmm. I'm not sure that's a bad thing. It's maybe surprising that they've chosen to go so much with the identity of the actual creators they've got, rather than trying to impersonate Kirby.
But, you know. Thing is, though, I'm glad they haven't tried to ape any of the comics that Kirby wrote, because, bless him, but he was a great artist. You know, I don't know if you've ever read his Captain America or his Black Panther. If you think Don McGregor did purple prose on Black Panther, you need to read Kirby's Black Panther stuff, because, honestly,
I think it depends on how seriously you think some of that stuff was meant to be taken, even at the time.
Well, I mean, obviously the Mad Bomb is not an idea that is to be said with a straight face, but at the same time, it's very, very dated. I think doing it in the style that Kirby did it in, even at the time, it was very stagey.
I think that's right. I mean, unfortunately, unless you're a comics historian or a Silver Age enthusiast, a lot of material from that period, yet however groundbreaking, however influential, hasn't aged particularly well.
Mm-hmm.
And there's a lot to be said for one of the reasons why Marvel and DC have survived for so long is because even though they haven't created very many concepts to equate with the burst of creativity that it was in the 60s, you can always reinterpret those same characters for the next generation and find an up-to-date way of doing what's essentially the same concept.
Yeah. One last point I'd like to mention on the art front is the restrained but effective use of Alex Ross's art, which is used to give grandeur to Jack Kirby characters when they appear, such as when there are two kind of celestial-style characters who come down from the sky at the beginning of the issue, and they're the only bit that are done in Alex Ross's art.
Similarly,
when Kirby characters give their big hurrah. It's not for all of them, you don't get it for Tiger 20 and things like that, but when the Midnight Swan first appears, you also get the flash of Alex Ross wow, which I think is probably going to be this book's way of showing you the Kirby grandeur when you can't just do Kirby dots everywhere.
Yeah, it works quite well actually. It's not inconsistent with the rest of the art, but mm-hmm. it gives it a different style that, as you say, gives it a slightly more epic feel.
Yeah. So that's Kirby Genesis, and we're going to move on to the official handbook, of the Marvel Universe. And I think this is the first time we've gone into Daredevil characters.
Is it?
Possibly.
Is
it? I don't remember having done any other Daredevil characters.
I think we might have had one, but...
Anyway.
Mr. Klein.
Mr. Klein was a Daredevil villain from the early 70s. And he was, as with so many Daredevil villains, a crime boss.
Yes.
Daredevil. He fancied himself as a master manipulator. He was playing off guys like the Owl, and he had the Black Widow under his thrall for a while.
He was, blackmailing Foggy Nelson when he wanted to be the governor.
Yeah.
These are your standard sort of Daredevil stories. And he's a mysterious crime lord who's manipulating people.
Yes. Now, where this moves away from being a traditional Daredevil character is the fact that he's also a time-travelling robot who can shoot lasers from his eyes.
Yeah, and I haven't read any of these stories, but from the way this handbook entry is written, I cannot help wondering whether what happened was that they had a mysterious crime boss running around for a couple of years,
mm-hmm.
and then somebody said, we really ought to give this guy an origin story.
Mm.
Let's make him a time-travelling laser-eyed robot.
And everyone else in the office had gone out for lunch. And so they were like, quick, get these pages to Gene Colan as fast as you can.
A lot of odd things were done in the early 70s in Marvel. this guy's manipulating characters for reasons which are never very clearly explained.
No.
And when they finally get around to explaining it, the explanation given is that he is actually Robot MK9 from the 120th century, where humanity has died out. And a computer called Baal, which was created to govern Earth, but had no one to govern because everyone was dead, sent him back in time 12,000 years to set in motion events whose repercussions would affect Earth 100 centuries to come. So he's been sent back in time to avert the death of the human race. Mm. And in order to do this, he has set about...
Foggy Nelson.
Foggy Nelson.
Foggy Nelson, the most important man in history.
If Foggy Nelson had become governor of New York State,
see,
the human race would have been annihilated, but only several centuries in the future, following the creation of the global supercomputer Baal.
See, he also tried to manipulate the Black Widow into romancing Daredevil. Now, what I'm seeing with this is a guy who has come back in time to ensure that a particular couple get together so that his future can come about. Now, I'm hearing Huey Lewis in the news here. I'm seeing Mr. Klein on a skateboard hanging onto the back of a truck. This is basically Marty McFly, Daredevil villain.
It's, I mean, I can just about get the idea of him trying to set up Daredevil and the Black Widow if you say that, if you play the, well, their kid is going to be really important card. But
maybe he's just a pervert. Maybe he's just like, yeah, I want to see Black Widow and Daredevil do it.
That's disturbing.
It is disturbing.
Is that Frank Cho again?
No, Frank Cho. Frank Cho, he's got his own little comics he's sitting writing. He's like, oh, I think I should do Black Widow and Daredevil. What do you think? And Black Widow, right, all her clothes fall off.
So, yeah, I mean, the way this story ends is that Klein is approaching the Black Widow in Switzerland, and there's some scheme involving manipulating the Daredevil and the Black Widow with a cure for blindness. And then finally, Daredevil confronts Mr. Klein, who reveals that he's a robot from the 120th century.
To be honest, that's the element of surprise. That is absolutely... Daredevil was not expecting that.
Then Daredevil beats him repeatedly about the head.
Bear in mind, this is a guy who can lift 25 tons and shoot lasers.
And, well, to be fair, it doesn't say... It says that he received a head injury, I suppose, to be fair. He might have fallen off a castle or something. I don't know. They are in Switzerland. There's always a castle.
Yeah,
it's a
70s in comics, definitely.
And as Klein is struggling to get back in the fight, two empathic robots from the 170th century arrive, called the Final Sons of Man, who destroy Klein and go home. So he's killed by a Deus Ex Machina robot.
Rocks fall, everyone dies. Yes.
I've always quite liked these stories where writers take a character who has a mystery plan that nobody can explain, and then try and explain it in the most desperately flimsy way imaginable. So what were you trying to do there, Mr. Klein, by interfering with the crime operations on the Lower West Side of Manhattan? Well, you see, in 120 centuries time, it's going to be vitally important that...
that these zoning permits were granted to these mobsters.
Yes.
If this man can't park his car here, then the human race will become extinct. Because when you're going back that far, the scale of it, you pretty much are into stepping on butterflies territory. The chain of events is so long and so, you know, so risky to disrupt any element of it that you have to be unbelievably confident that that is exactly what needs to be done at that point in time. Or alternatively, it could be that Baal is so bored that he's basically doing the equivalent of being some teenage kid with an air rifle taking pot shots out the window. He's just firing things into the past to see what happens.
Yeah, it seems they never actually explained what Klein was trying to achieve or how anything that he had done was supposed to assist any of his goals in any way.
Yeah, and indeed, there doesn't explain the fact there presumably were robots marks 1 to 8 as well. What were they doing? Mr. Cone and Mr. Koo. I presume that they have all set up their own little manipulation plans. And I wonder if they are also trying to go, well, maybe we should see if we can get Hawkeye and Spider-Woman to hook up. Maybe that's what it is. Maybe any unbelievable romantic coupling in the Marvel Universe, maybe it's Black Panther and Storm's marriage was set up by the Mark VI android who's been sent back by Baal.
I think the official index should just start listing these characters behind the scenes in a particularly contrived story. But if it's something that makes no sense, then you know, it's probably a character who's secretly a robot from the 120th century shoving people in that direction.
Yeah, it does work as kind of an all-purpose, why did this happen, robot from the 120th century.
If only they'd given that origin to Mr. Sinister.
Yeah, so Mr. Klein, Marvel Universe's version of Match.com, and possible get-out clause for any unlikely romantic couplings. So yeah, that's the official handbook of Marvel Universe, and it's the end of the podcast. We're back in a fortnight's time, when we will try to keep it to an hour. Sorry it's gone on so long. You don't get 52 number ones that often, I have to say. But until then, you can catch us on our blog. We're at HouseToAstonish.com.
You can follow us on Twitter. I'm IvDestroyed and Al is House to Astonish.
You can email us. The email address is housetoastonish@gmail.com. And you can also get us on Facebook. Our Facebook fan page is there. Just go to Facebook and search for House to Astonish. And we will see you in 2 weeks.
See you then.
Bye.